Hey everybody, welcome to Sweater Weather, a podcast about Canadian arts and culture. I am Aaron Giovannone, a writer in Calgary, Alberta.
And I'm Naomi Lewis, a novelist and nonfiction writer in Calgary, Alberta.
Naomi, how are you feeling about our topic today? Kids in the Hall.
How am I feeling? A little confused, but I'm ready. I'm ready to go.
It is a confusing show. Mm-hmm. It's kind of all over the place.
Yeah, it leaves you feeling like you just got hit on the head with something. You're not sure what, but you're laughing.
So before we get started, I just want to remind everybody that patrons of the show over on patreon.com/Canadian Sweater get access to full episodes of the show. That's about twice the content that's available on the free feed. So if you're interested in getting the full episode about Kids in the Hall and all other episodes of Sweater Weather that come out, just head on over to patreon.com/Canadian Sweater and sign up. You'll see there's different tiers, different benefits, all kinds of other things available over there. So, the Kids in the Hall. What are your memories of Kids in the Hall?
From when it was on originally, yeah. I remember very vaguely seeing little clips of it and feeling kind of disturbed in an unpleasant way that made me not want to watch it anymore. And I always just thought I didn't like the show, basically. And I remember a lot of... When did it start? What year was it?
1988.
Okay, so yeah, I guess in high school. I started high school in 1990. Mm-hmm. So probably even before... So grade 7, 8, and then into high school, there were kids my age who watched the show, like boys, really, especially, and who would quote bits of it, like kind of in the same way that they would quote Monty Python, just like the same lines over and over in like a kind of like distressing, repetitive way that seemed more like obsessive than entertaining.
What were the quotable lines for teenage boys in the 1990s?
I'm crushing your head,
of
they
course,
would say. And they would
one.
Go like this. Crushing your head.
That's right.
And they would say it in a weird voice. I'm crushing our head.
Right, an Eastern European accent.
Yes.
Looking back at the show now, Mark McKinney is, yeah, his famous character. Mm-hmm. You realize, oh, that he's like imitating like a Czech person or something.
Yeah, or, no, I think he actually is Croatian. He says at one point.
Oh, he says he's Croatian.
Yeah, he does say he's Croatian.
Right, so that's funny. Yeah.
Yeah, and at one point he says he has like, he's angry because he thinks someone in his taxi. Or is that a different guy?
Yeah, he does another Eastern European character.
That guy's Croatian because he doesn't like Serbs, he says.
Oh, okay, that comes up in one of the episodes.
Yeah. That's right. And he says something about in the original Croatian, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But, yeah, so the crushing your head. And then the other one was the chicken lady where people would just go like, buck, 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 I'm the chicken lady. And it was just confusing to me.
I mean, these are great. These are great sketches. Rewatching the show, I have to say, I think I appreciate it more as an adult, mm-hmm. with just like a firmer sense of the world.
Yes.
That the show is actually spoofing and referring to. So,
yes.
Yeah, I think I didn't, I'm similar to you. I mean, Kids in the Hall was on TV so much. It was always on CBC. I grew up in the country where we had like 8 television stations on antenna.
Mm-hmm.
So CBC was one of the mainstays. It was always on. And Kids in the Hall seemed to be constantly playing, like late at night. I think it broadcast late at night.
Okay.
Relatively late at night in Canada, mm-hmm. too, so...
Yeah, I don't think I ever went out, like, tried to watch it. I feel like it might have been on at other people's houses or...
Yeah.
Yeah, I just was convinced that I hated it, so...
I likewise did not seek it out.
Yeah. And were you one of the boys that would go crushing your head and chicken lady?
Not too much.
Okay.
No,
not too much.
So. Not too much. I don't think I did.
Okay.
Yeah. If I did, it was just to fit in. Not because I really wanted to.
But isn't that why we did everything we did?
Yeah, so what's spurring our topic today is that Kids in the Hall just recently released a new season of their show after many years of not releasing seasons. So we're going to talk about a little bit the history of Kids in the Hall.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get into it. So did you know that Kids in the Hall began in Calgary?
I actually did.
Oh, you didn't know.
Tell me more.
So I guess you could say the Kids in the Hall begins with Bruce McCullough and Mark McKinney in 1981, mm-hmm. when they meet at Loose Moose Improv Theater.
Oh, we've been there.
We've seen shows. It's mm-hmm. It is like a a longstanding cultural institution in Canada. I have a few more things to say about Loose Moose a little bit later, but it is like kind of Calgary's second city. You know, mm-hmm. the way that second city is such a big thing in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And it's produced like a fair share of actors and comedians, like the FUBAR boys, David Lawrence and Paul Spence from the FUBAR series. Oh, yeah. They from there, and also Andrew Fung from Kim's Convenience.
Oh,
actually,
yeah.
The show we saw,
Andrew, that was him.
Andrew Fung was performing. I think that was before Kim's Convenience. Now, Bruce McCullough, he was actually from Edmonton. His father was a traveling salesman.
Okay.
His father drank a lot of rye and ginger.
Okay.
He was an alcoholic.
Oh, no.
But he had an artsy side, and this seemed to influence Bruce McCullough. Bruce McCullough really liked music. He was kind of a punk rocker. And his dad would blare music late at night when he was drunk. McCullough's mom worked at Woolco.
Oh.
Remember Woolco?
I do.
Yeah. Bought out by Walmart at some point in the 90s, I think. Now, Bruce McCullough was athletic, and he won like provincial like track and swimming titles in high school, and he lifted weights competitively, but he was bullied a lot for being effeminate.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So he ended up going to Mount Royal College at the time,
right.
Now a university.
Yeah.
So he moved to Calgary. He was studying business. Wasn't going very well.
Business, that's funny, because later on they would mock businessmen mercilessly.
Endlessly.
But he wanted to be a businessman at one point, so that's very interesting.
So a lot of this information today is coming from a book about the kids in the hall. It's called This is a Book About the Kids in the Hall by John Seemley. And so I think Seemley mentions, he makes a little joke in the book about you could play a drinking game with kids in the hall that involves taking a drink every time you see a businessman on screen. You wouldn't last very long, I don't think. There's so many businessmen. Now, Mark McKinney, he was a little bit different. He was actually the son of diplomats.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So he lived all over the world?
He did. Mexico, France, Trinidad.
Oh, wow.
So he ended up going to university at Memorial University in St. John's, Newfoundland, but moved to Calgary to work in the oil patch.
Really?
Which seems like a kind of youthful rebellion of like an upper middle class kid, probably.
Hmm.
But he started doing theater at Loose Moose, and Bruce McCullough like saw a show there and wanted to start doing it too. And so they did. And they met at Loose Moose. Now, on the other side of Canada, Dave Foley and Kevin MacDonald. They were, from Toronto. Those two met at Second City. They formed an improv group that they called The Kids in the Hall.
Okay, and do you know why they called it that? Or it was just...
The name, yeah. Well, it's good that you asked that. It is in my notes. So I guess it's a producer, like, at some point, told the kids when they were performing about a story involving legendary comedian Jack Benny at the Jack Benny Show. Apparently, young writers who wanted to sell Jack jokes for the show would hang out in the hall outside of the theater waiting for Jack to come out.
Mm-hmm.
And so he referred to them as the kids in the hall.
Uh-huh.
So outsiders trying to get in, trying to break into
mm-hmm,
the business.
Nice.
That's the origin of the name. Dave Foley was from Etobicoke. His mother was English, born in England. His father was a steam fitter and also a big drinker.
Which What's is a steam fitter?
A steam fitter is like a pipe fitter.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's like an industrial job.
Mm-hmm. A big drinker, okay.
And a big drinker. And you see a theme emerging.
Indeed.
Here. Foley dropped out of high school. He wasn't a good student. He did stand-up comedy for a year. And then he started taking improv classes. Kevin MacDonald, he's from Montreal originally. His family moved around like to Los Angeles, then back to Toronto. His father was a dental equipment salesman. And a severe alcoholic.
Oh, no.
Apparently pretty bad. In later years, MacDonald actually wrote a one-man play about his dad.
Oh, wow.
MacDonald studied acting briefly at Humber College. He got kicked out because he couldn't do drama. He couldn't do dramatic roles.
Okay.
So they kicked him out.
He could only be funny.
They called him a one-legged comedian.
Okay.
Or sorry, one-legged actor, because he could only do comedy.
Yeah, I can see
so
that.
So it made sense for him to go to him to do improv at the Second City. Right?
Yeah.
So that's the scene of the original four. We're going to get to Scott Thompson in a minute, the fifth member. So the Calgarians, McCullough and McKinney, they moved to Toronto along with other comedians from their group. Started performing in Toronto with the kids in the hall. I should say the Yeah, McCullough and McKinney's group, it was called The Audience. That's what they called it. Oh. Like a meta.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's like you get up there and say, well, ladies and gentlemen, the audience.
Oh, yeah. It's a bit much, really.
Yeah. It's a little too much. It's a little too much.
Clever. A little too clever.
Well, yes, too clever by half. I think there are a lot of meta moments because it is the 90s. And so that kind of thing was like avant-garde and cool. And you see it a lot in Kids in the Hall. But sometimes it works really well, actually.
Yeah, it's not surprising that they kind of went too far at one point and then reeled it back.
Yeah, exactly.
Into like the artsy meta kind of like fourth wall being broken thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, in the late 80s, this is still novel, I think, in the mainstream.
Yeah, but also like they were young and they were, you know, they had that kind of like, wow, we're going to be really smart about this. And, you know, everyone does at first.
Yeah, well, they have, I mean, the Kids in the Hall, I mean, seeing them again now, you're like, wow, for a main, like a show that was on CBC and was on HBO, it was mainstream show. Mm-hmm. Like it is very like artsy. It's like incredibly, it is incredibly like highfalutin, you might even say.
Yeah,
and you're like,
and
you're kind of surprised that that could happen. But I think it was a little bit different in the 90s.
Well, rewatching it recently, I realized that. But I think like when I first, my impression of it in the 90s was just that it was like pure slapstick, gross out humor, right?
Right.
And I think that was just because, again, because it was filtered through other kids my age who were quoting their favorite parts. And the only part that they could really grasp or like that we could really grasp with our puny brains was like the most silly parts.
Yeah. I mean, it did appeal at that on that level.
It did. Yeah, it had that level.
I think watching it now, I do appreciate it on other levels too. And I think at the time, more mature audiences did appreciate
it. Yeah, and that must have been why it was so popular. I mean, it couldn't like stand on silly grossness alone.
Yeah, well, we'll see when we get to the Kids in the Hall, like when they start performing together.
Mm-hmm.
Their origins are extremely artsy and extremely highbrow.
We're getting there. That's
so
interesting.
So just to finish up here with the five members. So Scott Thompson, he joined the group a little bit later. The Kids in the Hall had already started performing together.
Oh.
He was from North Bay. He moved to Brampton with his family when he was a kid. He was gregarious, well-liked. I mean, he's such a big personality on screen. That's not surprising. His dad did not like that he was gay or suspected him of being gay or whatever. So something weird about Scott Thompson, at his high school in Brampton, there was a school shooting in 1975.
Oh, my goodness.
When a student gunman wounded 13 and killed two people and himself. And Scott Thompson was there.
Oh, my goodness.
It was like his teacher was murdered.
Anyway, wow.
Yeah.
So his dad didn't like him being gay, to get back to that. So it sounds like, I mean, all of these kids in the hall, like they didn't have the best dads. Is it fair to say?
It's fair to say.
Yeah.
And you can tell with all the dad characters.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of bad dads. There's a lot of grumpy old men.
Yes.
A lot of drinkers.
A lot of drinkers.
Yeah.
Yes. A lot of grumpy dads. That's a major theme.
It really is.
Yeah. Huh. And what about their moms? They were like...
Well, I mean, I don't know. I didn't come across anything about Scott Thompson's mom. But to me, I'm assuming he had a nice mom. Why? Only because he plays mother characters so well.
Yeah, he does.
I mean, I love Scott Thompson's mother characters. They're kind of a traditional housewife.
Very loving,
very like caring up for the kids, especially worried about them. But then there's always this other level of like basically tragedy.
Yeah.
Like there's this tragic element to these women who are trapped.
With
awful husbands stuck in their house, in their role. And to me, there's like incredible pathos with Scott Thompson's mother character. So I'm assuming that maybe he had a mother that he really loved.
Maybe.
Or was very caring and he felt sorry for on some level too. I'm not really sure. That's my conjecture. Because I didn't read anything more about Scott Thompson's mom. Mm-hmm. Now, he went to York University. He told his family that he was studying journalism. But he was actually studying theater. He was part of a comedy troupe called The Love Cats.
Oh, wow. That's so cute.
So as I said, he saw the kids performing and he threw donuts at them on stage. I guess they were having a bad a bad show. Really? But that was one of the ways he got noticed by them. He really did want to join the club in the group. And he
That's
did.
One way to do it.
And he did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the kids, they performed at the Rivoli Theater.
Rivoli.
On Queen Street West, downtown Toronto. This was like a restaurant in the front and a music venue in the back. And it was the hub of like the early 80s punk scene.
It was still there when I lived in Toronto.
It was probably still pretty hip. When was this? The early 2000s? It's still
there
now. You
know, I went to a show there for New Year's Eve 2003.
Okay.
And
I'm sure it was hip. I mean, it's still hip now.
And you know who was playing?
No way. Who?
The Sadies.
Oh, okay.
The Sadies, Dallas Good, member of the Sadies,
mm-hmm.
plays the theme song of the new season of Kids in the Hall.
Right, but that's before he passed away.
Yes.
Because he died now.
Yeah, recently.
Right.
Very recently.
Right, so the theme song was originally performed by Shadowy Men from a Shadowy Planet. Is that the name of the band?
Shadowy Men on a Shadowy
is
Planet,
that what it
I
is?
Think.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Rivoli, like in the 80s, was like super hip, super alternative. Like what happened in Toronto is like in the 60s, like the first bohemia alternative neighborhood was Yorkville.
Oh, okay.
That's where all the hippies and writers and musicians lived. Like Gordon Lightfoot lived there, Margaret Atwood lived there. Like that was bohemia.
Mm-hmm.
Which is hilarious to think about because Yorkville is like the most ridiculously... It's like comically gentrified. It's so shishi poo poo.
I mean, it's like aristocratic.
It's aristocratic now. Like that's where diplomats live or whatever.
Oh yeah, definitely.
So it's amazing. Anyway, that scene was like gentrifying, and so the art scene moved to Queen West because there was kind of it was a post industrial place.
Mm-hmm.
Rents were cheap, and so it became the center of a vibrant alternative art scene. And so, I have a quote here from a 1984 Globe and Mail article writing about the Rivoli. He says that Liam Lacey wrote, quote, "The spirit of self-conscious bohemia haunts the back room of the Rivoli restaurant on Queen West. Abstract geometric art decorates the right-hand wall, mirrors on the left. Not only are you surrounded by art, but you can see yourself surrounded by art. Cool or what?"
Cool.
So,
but you know what? It's actually pronounced Rivoli.
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 Okay, what was I saying?
Rivoli.
The Rivoli. Well, I'm saying it the Italian way.
Oh, so you're saying it right. I see.
Everyone else is wrong.
I got it. Okay, that's acceptable.
So there was a Monday night comedy show at the mm-hmm. at the Rivoli, and the Kids in the Hall eventually took it over because they performed there so much.
Mm-hmm.
So they would, this was like a weird thing about the Kids in the Hall. They would never do the same sketch twice.
Wow.
Yeah. So this was Bruce McCullough's insistence.
But it wasn't improv.
They improvised.
Oh, it was improv.
And they would never do the same sketch twice. So that's like they're always improvising. Everything was just an improv.
Okay.
And so they wouldn't repeat their material.
Wow.
Why not? Bruce McCullough, this is something he insisted on. He'd learned it from the Loose Moose. And this is a quote from Bruce McCullough. He said, "If you ever repeated material, you were a hack."
Hmm.
This was like this kind of pure... artistic improv in intent.
Well, I mean, to be fair, it's not improv anymore if you do it again.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
But guess what? The shows were incredibly inconsistent.
Which improv always is.
Exactly. And the audience wasn't really growing.
Okay.
They'd have 15, 20 people, basically, for their shows for this first several months that they did it. They actually thought they might call it quits, too, because it was just like wasn't really gaining a following.
Wow.
Then in March of 1984, they did like a best of sketches. So mm-hmm. where they like presented their most popular material. So they decided, okay, we are going to repeat our sketches. Mm-hmm. We're going to choose the ones that we know work best or mm-hmm. that people like best, and that really worked. And the Kids in the Hall suddenly like really became a hot ticket.
So do you know if it was kind of like loosely scripted or was it like scripted word for word? If you know what I mean.
I think what happens is, I mean, by the time you're watching it, you're watching Kids in the Hall on TV, like there's a script. It's written and they're following
it. It's written,
it.
Okay.
But improv is like a technique for coming up with new material, right?
Yeah.
And then trying it out and then seeing what works and then refining it. So that's how improv is generally now used in comedy.
Okay.
I think if you were a purist... live theater type, as Bruce McCullough was, like he's, I think, very of the group, I think he's like one of the more intentionally, self-consciously artistic.
Okay.
That you'd want to do, no, I'm an improv guy. I only improv. We never repeat anything. That's mm-hmm. That's hack. That's bullshit. Like, that Got was it. Kind of Bruce McCullough's purest intention. But yeah. It didn't work until they actually started to refine the material that they came up with while doing improv.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So they would do, I mean, the shows would be like part of it improv, part of it prepared sketches too. Like, that's kind of what the kids in the hall would end up doing. What kind of improv were the kids in the hall? I mean, it's not like improv was around before them, right? So you might say that they were like the second wave of improvisational comedy. So the first wave being like Second City.
Mm-hmm.
So the second wave coming from something called theater sports. This was something that they did a lot at Loose Moose. So theater sports was like part of an improv theory put forth by a guy named Keith Johnston. Now, he was a British actor who came to Calgary and was a longtime professor at the University of Calgary. And he co-founded the Loose Moose Theater using his like techniques and theories of improv. And so theater sports was a big part of that. Theater sports being competitive, where you have teams of improvisers competing against each other for points from the audience or from a judge or something like that. Mm-hmm. So there's a competitive energy to it.
And he invented that, or like coined that term?
He coined the term, and okay. maybe developed the system in a book from 1979 called Impro, Improvisation and the Theater. So this was like his famous book, and I think it was used as like a manual to teach uh-huh. improvisation. So that's the Calgary influence, but theater sports, it goes beyond Calgary. And indeed, the Toronto guys, Kevin MacDonald and Dave Foley, they're doing theater sports too. And in fact, that's like how these groups interact with each other, because they compete against each other in theater sports.
Got events. It.
Yeah. So now, so there's frantic competition. There's also like traditional improv. Like, it was really quick to, like, it was really about establishing the characters in the scene and the place of the scene and all that, all those details of a scene as quickly as possible. Whereas this kind of Johnston style, it focused more on unleashing like childlike creativity and even revealing Freudian depths.
Ooh.
So it encouraged, you know, what you might think of as like strange and surreal connections to emerge
mm-hmm.
in a more liberated way. You can see, yeah. So that's maybe, I think you can kind of see that in the Kids
Absolutely,
in the Hall style.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another influence on the Kids in the Hall is obviously Monty Python.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, especially with the plain female characters.
Yeah.
So they were very aware when they became popular that they were, yeah, clearly like similar to Monty Python. Mm. So they were consciously trying to do something a little bit different, but the connections are there.
Yeah, definitely.
They also made a conscious choice to not do parody of news items or current events or celebrities the way that SCTV did, and the
okay.
way that and the way that SNL
that's right yeah they
SNL
never did
does.
That yeah.
They never did that. They were aware that that would date the material, which is true, because going back and watching
sure.
you know, you're like, you can watch that again, you can watch the Kids in the Hall now and really enjoy it, and it doesn't feel
of course it feels dated in some ways in yeah. the sense of technologies and
yes
fashions and stuff, but yeah, like not referring to people that are no longer front of mind, let's say.
Yeah,
like, yeah, it is. It
well,
is
or people
pretty,
that know you wouldn't even know.
Yeah, for sure. But even like not referring to like the prime minister or the president or
yeah.
like people that you would probably know, but it's just not really something that you think about very much. Yeah, it's smart.
I think like it stands up better than watching old SNL skits or something where it's referring to like events of the day and stuff. So mm-hmm. They didn't want to be topical. They wanted to do something else. And what they ended up doing is like their material comes from, it seems to be just about more about like everyday life,
mm-hmm.
Quotidian characters, fathers, mothers, we've talked about businessmen, cab drivers. It's just about, it's about like their, you know, I guess you'd say an everyday world.
Yeah, it's almost domestic in a lot of ways.
A lot of it's domestic.
Yeah.
A lot of it is a workplace, or a lot of it is out on the street too. But it's just
yeah.
like the everyday world from kind of a personal perspective that
yeah.
somehow is also very relatable.
Yeah, I guess like family life and work life are like their often their targets, right?
I think it ends up being more personal and relatable because it's not about celebrities or public figures in other ways or big, you know, they're not making, I mean, if they're satirizing something, I mean, they are, it's something much more intimate.
That's right.
Than what you'd normally get in like with the impression of a president or something.
And there's also, I mean, that kind of observational humor that was like really popular then where it's like minutia of human interactions, like where someone has a crumb stuck to their face and like they can't get it off and the person's like,
you mean Bruce McCullough as like a kind of a greasy businessman?
Yeah, yeah, and he has a piece mustache. Of food in his mustache.
He has a cucumber.
And he can't get it out, and it just like goes to absurd levels. But that kind of recognizable moment where you don't know if you should tell someone if they have something on their face, and then you tell them, and then they think they got it off, but it's still there, and you have to keep saying, no, it's still there. Yeah. I mean, it's like that kind of minute observation. And then,
yeah, I mean,
like almost Seinfeldish, and it's,
yeah,
you know,
Seinfeld is happening, you know, the kids and all runs to 95. Mm-hmm. So Seinfeld is not that long. Like, I mean, that's happening already, Seinfeld in the 90s. So
yeah. I mean, it's definitely grosser and goes further into like just absurd grotesquery. But there's a bit of a similarity there.
Just for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kevin McDonald would do a guest spot on Seinfeld in the late season.
Really?
I think he plays a guy named like Denim Guy. They call him Denim Guy because he wears all denim.
Okay.
And he's trying to go out with Elaine.
Okay.
If I remember correctly. In 1985, there was a glowing review in the Globe and Mail of The Kids in the Hall. The talent scout from Saturday Night Live happened to see that review. And so decided they should have to set up an audition for The Kids in the Hall, because SNL would regularly scout Toronto looking for, they'd go to Second City and see who's been performing and see if anybody's like appropriate for the cast on SNL. I don't know if they still do it like that in that same way. They're selling out their tickets. They're getting like 300 or 400 people to a show, right? Mm-hmm. People are lined up around the block to see them. So that gets out into the wider press and global.
Sounds fun.
Yeah. It sounds like probably the ideal time to have been a Kids in the Hall fan.
Yeah.
The talent scout was actually Pam Thomas, the now ex-wife of Dave Thomas, one half of the McKenzie brothers.
Okay.
Yeah, just as an aside.
Okay.
So at this audition, the producers of SNL were there, including Al Franken and head writer Jim Downey.
Nice.
So what happened is SNL decided to take two of the group.
What? That's so
pretty
evil.
Stupid, eh?
Which two?
It was Bruce McCullough and Mark McKinney. It was the Calgary guys. Huh. They wanted them as writers for Saturday Night Live in the 1985 and 86 season.
Did they do most of the writing for Kids in the Hall, or like, why them?
It seems insane, but of course the Kids in the Hall were not known really that well yet. And it's SNL, so they get to do what they want. Now, SNL was not making good decisions. That year was famously terrible. So they hired a bunch of actors instead of comedians to be on SNL. This included Joan Cusack and Robert Downey Jr. There's other people named I didn't write down who are like, oh, that's an actor I sort of half know.
Okay.
They're not really comedian. I mean, the tradition had been to get people from sketch and from stand-up, right? That had been the tradition. Mm-hmm. And so they were trying something new. They thought maybe, oh, well, like kind of, we might spice it up.
Mm-hmm. So
with better looking, more whatever, like Hollywood types.
Got it. So what happened though? Like Bruce and Mark, like they...
The season was a huge flop.
Oh, so they went.
They went and they worked on it and they barely got anything, any of their sketches in. Apparently the 30 Helens Agree sketch, Bruce wrote that for SNL.
Oh, wow.
And they never took it.
Oh, big mistake.
Well, I don't know if it would have worked on SNL. So they came back to Toronto after the failed season, and the troupe came together again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, SNL producer and comedy kingmaker Lorne Michaels was not finished with the kids. He still liked them. He saw them perform all together at the Rivoli in a private audition in 1986. He decided that they should stay together and that he was going to help them along.
Mm-hmm.
So he flew them to New York, provided them with stipends and office space, and then had them perform regularly at Caroline's, which is a famous stand-up comedy venue on Broadway.
Wowzers.
He was preparing them to film a pilot for a television series.
Okay.
Which he arranged. He ended up getting $400,000 from HBO to film this pilot, and then it was filmed. And it was aired as a one, it was aired as like a special, but everyone understood, well, if it does well, that maybe this would lead to a series. It was aired October 18th, 1988. It was like at 12:30 in the morning.
And that would have been like NBC or something?
This was aired on HBO.
HBO.
It was on. Okay, it was aired on HBO, so a private, like a private cable audience. At 12:30 in the morning, so it's like.
What on earth?
Yeah, so it is like the most on television at the time. It must be the freest space possible.
Yeah, right.
Like it's HBO.
Yeah.
Where you can swear and there's nudity and stuff because it's a private subscription.
Yeah.
And it's latest. At night, right? So. This like special, it already had a lot of the sketches that would become the classic famous ones, including Cabbage Head and Crush Your Head Guy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the other one that kids were really into, was the Cabbage Head.
The Cabbage Head Guy. Yeah, so Bruce McCullough is like playing like a, you know, an old-fashioned misogynist guy. He's like smoking a cigar and coming on to ladies.
In a very disgusting
way. In a very disgusting way, but when they are repelled by him, he goes, is it because he plays, suddenly he flips to like being sad and pathetic and like, is it because of my cabbage head you don't like me?
Yeah, he just has a bunch of cabbage leaves stuck to his head.
Yeah, that's all he is.
So the way that that was interpreted for me via my teenage acquaintances was just like, I have a cabbage on my head. And people would just keep saying that.
That's really the least of it.
Yes.
But it is the most obvious.
Yes. All right.
Yeah,
anyway.
You can see kids, it works for kids. But like as a kid, I don't think I connected to that sketch because I was like, the cabbage on his head is not enough for me.
No, me neither. But for some people, it was enough.
But what I didn't get, and which I get now when I see it, is like, oh, like the gender dynamics. Like, that's what's happening. It's like, oh, this guy's a total skeez.
Yeah.
It's something you have to, I think, have grown up a little bit to maybe understand.
Yeah, I think so too. You also have to have actually watched it and not just heard it interpreted through other people.
You had never even seen it?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. Well, CBC and HBO together, they ordered 22 episodes.
Okay.
Thanks again for watching or listening to this free version of Sweater Weather. To get access to the full version of the show, this episode on Kids in the Hall and other episodes of Sweater Weather, become a patron. Support the show over on patreon.com/Canadian Sweater, and you'll get access to about twice the content, twice the runtime of this episode and all other episodes of Sweater Weather. And of course, you'll be helping us out, and we'll much appreciate it. Thanks again.